You're listening to The Witness Interview Podcast. I'm Robert Reed, and we're here with Yoni Pryor, actor, theatre maker, and academic. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So we've got Yoni in to talk about a range of things, but with particular reference, I thought it would be interesting to talk about the company that Yoni was involved with in the 90s, which was, I won't say seminal, but I will say one of those kind of companies that everybody talks about and everybody still remembers, at least of that generation, right? And that's Gilgal, Australia's first and I believe still only professional Jewish theatre company.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, so I did this to Patricia last time, I put a bunch of stuff to jog your memory.
Oh,
so I
yes.
have a bunch of programs and little kind of postery sort of thing, I'm not entirely certain, that are from the productions that Gilgal put together, which was led by a, I'll say, younger Barry Koskin. And that included S. Brent, The Dibbuk, Levard, The Wilderness Room, and The Operated Jew.
That's right.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah. And so Yoni was in some of those and was a part of the company. And I am fascinated to hear about what it was like working with the company, who was in it, obviously, and all that sort of stuff, and about the kind of work. One of the things that I think we lose a lot of, even though we sometimes can hold on to the names and the places and stuff, we lose the sense of what the work itself actually was. And so hearing about it from someone who was involved in it, much less saw some of it, I think is really valuable. So go.
Well, you know, in a way, you know, where it's placed in time means that we were not well documented. We didn't have the sense that so many companies do now, that what we were doing was part of some historical trajectory that needed to be noted. So there are some fairly rubbishy videos.
Mm.
And, of course, the work was quite dark. So things are very hard to see on 90s video. There was one, we did film the Dibbuk late one night, I think at the end of the first season, after the show, and it was pouring with rain, and because we were performing in this filthy, abandoned mechanics workshop, there was rain pouring through the roof.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
I thought that was just going to be about the noise, but actually coming into
the theater. Coming through the roof, terrific. Absolutely. And I remember at the one of the final images was Tom and I, after this sort of extraordinary tussle to exercise the Dibbuk from my body, we would sort of totter over to the back corner and hang on these butcher's hooks that Peter Corrigan had hung along the back. And we were so hot and it was so cold that we were just emanating steam. So there's this phenomenal image of the two of us hung desolately in the corner with steam rising
Amazing.
From our bodies. It was, yeah. But then somehow we messed up the sound. And so we all sound like we're underwater all the way through.
Yeah, you're right.
Which for a play that had quite a lot of text in multiple languages and lots of songs was a wee bit sad.
Hmm. So you mentioned Tom. That's Tom Wright.
Yes.
And the others in the company from memory were Michael Cantor, your good self. Can't think of the musician.
Elisa Gray?
Oh, no, that's not who I was thinking of, but that's that as well.
Yeah.
No, or designer maybe. Am I thinking of the designer?
Peter Corrigan was the designer on all of them.
Yeah, I'm going to check the program since I have them right in front of me.
And they did, who the cast shifted slightly from show
Louise
to show.
Louise Fox, that's who
Louise
I'm thinking
Fox
of.
Louise came Fox came in for from S. Brent.
Mm.
So she came in from the second show. Rosalie Zeicher was in the second show, and that was all. And the final show was just Tom, Michael and Lou, and Levard was just me.
Just you, yeah.
Or me and Barry.
Yeah.
Fighting it out on a foot of rock salt.
And bashing away at the piano too,
oh my
right?
God, yes. That was a sort of long battle because that was a hard show to do. Physically, it was an incredibly hard show to do.
Mm.
And Barry just got faster and faster because the better he knew the show, the more he wanted it to run, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd do these circuits past the piano as part of the show and I'd be giving him these sideways grimaces going, slow down, I can't run this fast.
So what's the order they went in from memory?
So it began with the Dibbuk.
Yeah,
and
so
then
must have been S. Brent.
That's right. And then
Levard. And then
The Wilderness Room. And then The Operated Jew.
Yeah. So tell me about the Dibbuk.
Well, the Dibbuk is the sort of the great classic of the Yiddish theatre. And, of course, the Yiddish theatre had this extraordinarily brief and rich flowering for a number of reasons, partly religious, because a bit like Islamic art, representational art is frowned on. Mm. In Orthodox Jewish tradition, yeah, there wasn't really a Jewish theatre until the mid to late 19th century, certainly not in Yiddish. Mm-hmm. And the Dibbuk has this amazing story behind it, which we used. So we sort of interwove the story of its making and of its author into this performance. So Solomon Ansky was a folklorist. The writer was a folklorist. Mm-hmm. And he went into all sorts of remote Eastern European shtetls collecting folk tales and myths. And he became very fixed on the Dibbuk. So he wrote this play based on the Dibbuk, the story of a young woman who is promised in marriage to a young man. And then the father decides that she should marry somebody else. And the young man dabbles in the dark arts, in the Kabbalah, and dies as a result and then possesses her body and emerges on her wedding day and then has to be exorcised. And at the very end, she is given the choice whether to return to life or to travel into death with her beloved, and she chooses the latter. And he took this play to the Vilna Trupp, who were a very, very serious, earnest young company in Vilna, and they wouldn't even look at it because they were into something else. They were very serious. They were into maybe early constructivism, but they were really into the sort of realist mode.
Yeah.
And they really didn't want to be doing folk theatre. So he was turned down, and then he conveniently died. And so the company decided through the 30 days of mourning that they would put the show on in tribute to him. Ah. And it became this, in Hebrew you call it a Schlager. It became an extraordinary hit. They toured it all over the world to Jewish communities all over the world. It was then done in Russia. It was the Stanislavski studio had the original Habima. So it had a Hebrew-speaking theatre attached to it. And they did it then in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And that company then ultimately moved to Israel and became the National Theatre of Israel. And so it is so deep in the in the sort of Jewish theatrical, historical imagination. And the part of Hannah, the young bride, remains, it's like the King Lear for women. It's the role you test yourself against. And so the great divas of Yiddish theatre and Hebrew theatre generally have done a Hannah in their careers. Hannah Rovina, who was Leah, her name is. Hannah Rovina is the name of the actress, who was the great diva of Israeli theatre. Mm. And she came from Russia, and that was her signature performance. And she was still doing it in her 60s, which is what we based my character on, an old woman who was still playing this young bride.
There's so much in that, right? Like there's just so many. I can just imagine how furiously one would have to follow along with the work to be able to get everything. So the 90s was that kind of, especially in Australia, was that beginning of the awareness of that sort of postmodern approach to making theatre, which is all about broadcasting on as many different layers as you possibly can.
Yeah, exactly.
So I've read the reviews from all of them.
Yeah.
And I recall that, so when I was a little kid, I heard about this stuff because I was uni at the time. And I remember hearing about Gilgal as this kind of incredibly transformational and important company. And then you go back and you read the reviews, and the reviews of the first Dibbuk were sort of generally fairly lukewarm, except for one which raved about it. I can't remember who it was. It might have been
Helen. Helen at The Age and Alison in The Bulletin.
Oh, yes.
Ali Grogan in The Bulletin.
And then the following year, everybody.
When we did the return season.
So what was the audience's response like? Because especially for the first one, was mostly pitched at the Jewish community?
We were bewildered at the response because, I don't know, when you're in it, you don't really know what you're making. And when you're making, you know, because this was not, we didn't just do the play. It was constructed. It was devised, if you like. It used chunks of the play with bits of actual and invented biographies of actual and invented characters and types. And I don't think, the stakes were very low. You know, we were working nights and weekends. Was just, suck it and see. Let's see what happens. So we were a bit stunned, maybe. I was, at the strength of responses. And that included from the Jewish community. Maybe because we did work in Yiddish and Hebrew, because we did use, if you like, genuine cultural artifacts. So we had a lot of songs in Yiddish, you know, folk songs and songs from the Yiddish theatre. So I think there was enough absolutely recognisable material for a Jewish audience to hook into, even if they were not aficionados of avant-garde or postmodern theatre. The postmodern thing was a bit of an in-joke, actually. You know, Tom was our resident boffin. Tom Wright is the smartest man on earth. Occasionally we'd come in after a show and say, Tom, could you just explain postmodernism to us again?
I imagine he took every opportunity to do so. Yeah. Speaking of the group of you as kind of young theatre makers still working at night and all that sort of stuff, my understanding is that the company comes about and the project comes about after Barry had gone to Europe. So did he go away on a kind of holiday or went and sort of spent a year in Europe travelling around?
He had some sort of fellowship in Germany.
He'd already been working with Treason of Images and come out of Melbourne Uni, right? Almost out of student theatre, really.
He did. Yeah. And in fact, they were the sort of pre-existing relationships, was he and Michael and Tom had worked together a lot at Melbourne University. And then, you know, he picked the girls up along the way at various other points.
I was going to say, out of where?
I'd been working in Israel for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And somewhere in the middle there, I came back for a couple of months and did a show with Peter King, who was an old mate of mine. And in that, I spoke some Hebrew. So that he'd remembered. And so he came and found me. I think Elisa and Rosalie, he also advertised in the Jewish News.
Right.
So he did some auditions, and that's the way Elisa and Rosalie came. And Louise had come out of Julian Merrick's Kickhouse. So he just assembled. It all becomes a bit mythological, doesn't it? Somewhere in there, he'd applied for ongoing funding, I think, for Treason of Images and not got it. And so thought, well, fuck you. I'm going to do my own thing then.
Yeah.
I'm going to return to my roots and I'm going to really start asking questions about what it is to be Jewish. And I think it was certainly things like going to Prague, and there was a documentary made about the company where he talked about what it was to go to the Prague Jewish Cemetery. And have a sense of the sort of spectral presences in that space. But he also at some point went to New York and picked up a book of a collection of songs from the Yiddish theatre.
Oh, yeah.
Because Broadway began as a line of Yiddish theatres for Jewish immigrants.
Yeah.
And so, we would always, I think, start from this sort of array of materials and then work out how we might fit them together, chunk them against each other, layer them on top of one another. And we worked slowly. Well, certainly with a Dibbuk, we worked slowly, and I just think that's the greatest gift you can ever give to a bunch of artists. Oh, yeah. When we started, we didn't have the opening night. We had our own space. We had this filthy garage, but it was ours.
Why the garage? Excellent. The first three?
No, the first two.
Yeah, okay.
We're done there.
I should know that because the other one sitting in front of me has got a Playbox logo on it. Why the garage in
Carlisle Street?
Yeah, Carlisle Street.
Barry definitely wanted to do it in a space that was not a theatre. And looked at a number of spaces, and this was given to us.
Yeah, right.
I mean, not lock, stock and barrel, but it was lent to us by the owner. And it was the most amazing resonant space. They had these sort of three chambers and this huge sliding metal door between the front chamber and the middle chamber. And so, in fact, when the audience came in, ultimately they had to open this little service door in this massive metal door, in this massive metal wall. The resonance of walking into the gas chambers was sort of inescapable. And then beyond the middle chamber, which was our performance space, was this long, dark other chamber that we would emerge from. So it just, in the end, the Torah, the holy books that we were using, and in Tom's case eating, were old cards in cut-off oil tins that we had found in a corner of the space. So then the space determined the shape of the work in lots of ways, what the space would allow us to do and would not allow us to do.
Yeah, well, those kind of spaces are really great for that sort of stuff, right? Like, that not only do they inform and give shape to the work, but also they provide affordances, right? And you can just build on them.
Absolutely. And you would hear the trams.
Oh, yeah?
You know, here we were in the Jewish heartland of Melbourne, anyway, with this space that was industrial, dirty, large, you know, metal doors and the sound of trams coming through, which if you had half an inkling about 20th century Jewish history would immediately remind you of the trams that went through the Warsaw Ghetto. Or even if you didn't, you know, it was all there if you were alert to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were about to get into the process. So you guys worked slowly and along. What were you guys doing? Like, what was the approach? Was it come in, sing the song? I know there was a lot of come in, sing the songs.
Yes. and Barry playing bits of chorus line in between. So everyone thinks he's terribly serious, but in fact, he's enormous fun.
That's a great detail. I love that.
Yeah.
But yeah, how did you work? How did you actually approach and build it?
So we had this narrative, which in lots of ways we borrowed directly from Tadeusz Kantor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little bit dead classy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this fundamental narrative was that somehow these souls of Yiddish actors were trapped somewhere between life and death, life and the extinction of consciousness or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in some sort of space where they were forced to repeat bits of their performances that they had done over and over again in their lives. So there was a sort of interesting tension already because there were four of us and Tom and I were the terribly serious actors, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds terribly simple when I talk about it and I don't think it manifested quite as simply as that. And then Michael and Elisa were like these, in Yiddish you call it Schund, the like low theatre,
mm-hmm.
cabaret, clowning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they were the sort of low theatre actors who somehow found themselves in this D-book space where they were somehow compelled by forces in the space to recreate fragments of that were constantly being broken up by, you know, lights going on and off or strange objects appearing in the space. So we did bits of the play, I think enough of the play to hold on to the narrative structure, but broken with bits of biography and some of that happened almost accidentally. So at one point I did a sort of long monologue in a wheelbarrow because we used wheelbarrows to trundle people and things around, and we had to effect a set change, which was a set change from a cemetery to a wedding. So we had to cover that change. So they just sort of left me in the middle of the stage in my ridiculous wedding dress in a wheelbarrow, and we ended up sort of improvising this mad dialogue between the actress and the absent director.
Mm.
And I stopped to have a smoke, you know, so there's smoke billowing out of my mouth and I'm trying to remember the song and argue with the director at the same time, and then whoops, suddenly the actors came in and swept me up into the next scene. It was bricolage.
Yeah.
It was assembly, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tom brought in a whole lot of added sort of mystic writings that got sort of interpolated, more visions. There were elements of the play that we actually amplified and bits that we cut out entirely and then sort of, yeah, stuck together. But I guess it was bookended by these actors coming into the space, and then at the end when we were all dripping wet because – you know, you never finish a Kosky show in the 90s, not in your underwear and dripping wet. I remember we all had to run to that big metal door and bang on it as if we could try and get out, desperate to get out, and the lights would come down on that. So it was doing bits. And in a way it was, you know, because not everybody could come every single rehearsal. So you work on that bit and then the logic then is, well, that bit leads us to think, oh, well, we could do this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about how the limitations or the constraints on you as you're rehearsing start to inform the sort of aesthetic and logic of the piece itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a really hard thing to teach. You know, I teach devising and my students really would like there to be a template like there is when you approach a text, you know. And I go, oh, no, it's not quite like that because you just did something really interesting. That's shifted the whole focus of the piece, actually.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It feels like a very student theatre influenced approach too, that kind of work with what you've got, because I feel like one of my bugbears at the moment is the way student theatre is kind of looked on by some of us in the industry, yet it's so incredibly important and so incredibly influential. So many of us come out of student theatre and learn those skills of, well, not everybody's always going to turn up to rehearsal, and we're not going to have X prop or what have you until opening night or whatever, so you've got to learn to be able to make with what you've got in the moment.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Well, I think it's interesting if you think about a number of directors who did change the face of theatre in Melbourne at least through the 80s and 90s, and I guess particularly, say, Peter King and Barry Kosky, who both emerged from Melbourne University, which was a very intellectually rich environment, and two very smart directors who had ideas that they wanted to test, but they had, if you like, inferior materials in that they didn't have trained actors to work with. Which means that access to conventional modes of representation are sort of cut off. You have to find another way of expressing those ideas that can encompass that, can claim that and not go, oh, we're just going to do pretendy acting here. We're going to pretend we're at the MTC. You have to build a framework that can make sense of that and that can unashamedly claim it. And I just think that's, if you think about the strength of their vision, I think that's a really big part of it. Neither of them particularly cared about conventional notions of polish or refinement or excellence, or was like, if I can't do that, but I can get this amazing energy and I can hurl these images onto the stage. If I keep the actors busy enough, maybe people won't notice that they can't act in a conventional sense.
It's a matter of keep the actors busy enough and art will come out of it.
Look, it was great for me because I am the world's worst overthinker as an actor. I can totally paralyze myself. And I feel like one of the things that got those performances out of me was the fact that I was just too busy to think. I had no time to go, did that ring true? Because I just had to get on, I had to get on and do the next thing, and I had to not fall out of the wheelbarrow or slide off the tower or, drop Tom or whatever.
Well, and that's that great thing about the fact of, I've worked with a lot of actors over the years who make acting very hard work. And it's so hard to watch them as well, as opposed to if you can keep them doing stuff, they don't do the acting, they just do the thing.
Task. And I think it makes better theatre.
Oh, absolutely.
Or get them to do nothing. That's also pretty good.
Yeah, especially if they've got a lot of energy, right?
Watching
don't move a muscle. It's fantastic. Tell me about Lavard, because that's the one woman, right?
Well, we didn't envisage a trilogy, so we did the Dibbuk. It did really well. We had another idea, so we did a return season to fund Esbrent. Esbrent was even more an ensemble piece, I think. We really did a lot of choral stuff and unison movement and swinging around strange structures that Corrigan had built in the space, wearing pig masks, banging things, popping out of tables. And I think at that point Barry said, there's a trilogy here. And we did hold on to the characters to a degree, or we held on to some of the characters from the Dibbuk and threaded them into Esbrent. Then he said, I think there's a solo show here in this character who was built on, an amalgam of Jewish theatre divas. And because I'd worked as an actor in Israel for a number of years, I sort of knew a few of these people. And I knew these stories. And in fact, Barry and I went back to Israel and interviewed a couple of people I'd worked with who'd been in the Vilna Troupe or whose parents had been in the Vilna Troupe. So we had that, and then we constructed this sort of journey for her, and we used another play for that and fractured that, and that was a play called Mirla Efros, which is, they called it the Jewish Queen Lear. So it follows a sort of King Lear narrative in that a difficult woman alienates her family and is cast out and eventually brought back into the bosom of the family by the one child that she had been particularly awful to. Yeah, so we used that as the, if you like, spine. And again, as the performance that this actor was compelled somehow to keep repeating and then built this story of constant displacement into it, which was based on not a particular story but a number of stories that we'd heard about companies who'd moved from Eastern Europe or from Russia, and then they'd moved to America, or they'd moved to another place in Europe, and they'd moved to Israel and it just hadn't worked, so they'd ended up in the colonies. And, there was a very vibrant Yiddish theatre here in Melbourne for a number of years, and that was begun by, at the Kadima, that was begun by people who had come out of the Vilna Troupe.
That's great too. I didn't know that. That's great. So as a one-woman show, was the process the same?
Was more or less. I think when you put Barry and I together in the room, was more locked down I can get very fixed on form. Mm. So it was very much about repetition,
mm-hmm.
you know, scenes repeating themselves with minor variations, which were a nightmare to remember.
Mm.
And I think trying to find the amazing energy of the other Gilgal shows on one body was quite a challenge. But we had a very demanding set.
Yeah.
So Corrigan.
And this was at Playbox as
Yeah, this we'd moved to the Playbox.
Yeah.
And we had to work differently, so we had to work faster
because
we were funded.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
And they'd have had a programmed season. They'd have
That's
expected,
right.
you know, you've got your 5 weeks and now get in the theatre.
That's right. And they wanted a name and an image before we'd even made the show. And they wanted the set before we'd even made the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I always find that very odd.
And they were furious. Corrigan had designed a series of sort of metal channels, sluices, if you like, and about 2/3 of the way through, we decided we only needed one, and they were really cross because they'd made them all and then we chucked them out. And we did it on rock salt, which looked phenomenal.
Yeah.
So it was also echoing, you know, Lot's wife, and but it was really hard to work on because it just dragged every drop of moisture out of the air. So I did whatever, 70 minutes with a very dry mouth.
God, exhausting.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's the fun.
That's the fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I got sick. We had to pull the show down for a week because I got sick. And unfortunately what it sparked was a whole lot, oh, you know, Barry Kosky drives his actors until they're dead.
Yeah.
And A, it wasn't true. And B, I thought, hang on, I made this show as well. Who am I here? A puppet? You know?
Yeah. That's the
what
great
am I,
man
chopped liver?
That's that great man history sort of
exactly.
thing, right? Like that the media really – eats up
exactly.
and really wants to go through, and I feel has sort of followed Barry around quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when was that? That was 94?
That was 93. So it was 1, 2, 3, and then 94 we took the trilogy to Sydney.
Yeah, right.
And we did them all back to back. We did the Dibbuk in the railway sheds in Redfern, and then we did Esprit and Levard at Belvoir.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was quite interesting taking Esprit into inside the theatre. The Levard was already used to being inside the theatre.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think it was another couple of years. I think we didn't do Wilderness Room till 95.
Well, he goes and becomes director of the Adelaide
Festival
and
right.
then comes back and does the other two, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. Well, no, he was doing it simultaneously. So he was flying in and out while we were doing Wilderness Room. And the Wilderness Room was, there were weeks at a time, we had no idea what we were doing. Like we were in despair. Absolute despair because the others had come so easily. I think because they were theatre about theatre.
Yeah.
So the material was immediately amenable. And then the Wilderness Room, we, you know, we simply began with this notion that there had been 12 Jews on the First Fleet.
Yeah.
And again, sort of that layering of, you know, we sort of placed it in a notional old age home with these very old people trying to remember the Passover ritual, how to conduct a Seder, but then cracking into, we did the arrival of the First Fleet in fridge boxes, whirling around in fridge boxes, and Barry was there with a harpsichord. That was a hard process, and when it came out at the end, it was incredibly stripped back.
Yeah,
it was not what people were expecting from us. They were wanting, I think we did end sort of in underwear, but we were dry. So they were expecting something much more spectacular, and
and
we were in a gallery space.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in this white space, and it was very refined.
Mm. Yeah, the reviews for the last two sort of reflect that as well. That there was a kind of no. We want what you did what we wanted from you.
Yeah.
Which then sort of also follows into The Operator Jew, because there was a lot of tension around the story of The Operator Jew as well. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that was based on an anti-Semitic novella from the 19th century, in which a Jew falls in love with a non-Jew and goes through all sorts of incredibly painful and torturous procedures, including surgical ones, to become a non-Jew and wins the girl. But when he gets her to the altar, suddenly the Jew emerges again, and the lips become thick and the tongue becomes thick and the nose grows again. You know, and there was some really interesting writing around that at the time about Jewish self-hatred and hatred of the body and you know, the sanitization of the body. And I loved that show so much. I mean, it was also amazing to just be able to watch it and not have to do it.
Yeah.
And they were going through these brutalizing sort of exercise regimes. It was like Steiner, you know, eurythmics on speed. It was wild, and this piano that came alive and things popped out of it, and Louise and Michael spraying air freshener all over themselves, all over. I loved that show. Yeah. And this strange Egyptian god, you're sitting there in the middle of the space all the time. I thought it was a brilliant piece.
Yeah. It's often that sort of thing where a company establishes itself and then tries to move beyond what it's done.
Yeah.
That then sort of, I've said several times, I'm sure already, that independent companies, and of course the 90s is the beginning of the independent companies as we sort of recognize them, because post the funding crash, you know, independent companies go from being the kind of big 30 people organizations with their own theater to being five people in a shed somewhere. They last about 7 years because they burn out the energy.
Yeah.
And often it's also about that kind of, well, we've done this a lot, we want to do something different, and it loses the audience.
Yeah.
Which is sort of where funding is needed to support you through your change and development and growth, rather.
Yeah. But you know, it's also, there is something, dare I say, organic about that.
Mm.
You know, suddenly we were not in our 20s, we were in our 30s. We were doing things having that you want to do with your life, having children, those sorts of things. So it's true that your priorities shift and other opportunities open up. It was only a few years after that, I think, that Barry went off to Vienna. Or even though I feel enormously nostalgic because I've never been in a room like that before or since.
Yeah, I bet.
With that group of both like-minded but incredibly challenging people, the thing was done. The thing was over, and we've all gone on to do, I hope, other interesting things if they haven't made quite the sort of same splash.
Yeah.
We turned down. There was a point at which we were encouraged by the Australia Council to apply for ongoing funding. And in fact, we turned it down.
Yeah, right.
Or not turned it down. We said, no, I don't think we want to do that.
Yeah.
We don't think we want to be compelled to make one or two pieces a year. We don't really want to be that sort of ensemble. Like, this is our luxury space. And we'll go off and do whatever we need to do to, you know, make money to keep us going. And Barry obviously had, you know, this whole trajectory with extraordinary opera directing, and Michael was developing his practice as a director, and Tom and Louise were developing their practice as writers. And so there was something that made sense about going, no, we don't want to become a fixed ensemble who is therefore has to tick boxes and meet KPIs and produce a particular amount of work within a particular time.
Well, and in fact, I mean, aside from the fact that just because the Australia Council encourages you to go, it doesn't mean they're going to give you the money. But also, even if they do, like the way a rehearsal room shapes work, those demands shape work too, right?
Yeah. And of course, I went on to do a number of years at the Australia Council on the theatre board. So suddenly that landscape opened up.
Yeah.
To me, and it was always very interesting to look at the funding landscape and then look at the work that companies were doing and try and work out how one was speaking to the other.
Yeah.
Impacting on the other.
Yeah. That is always really interesting to see that. And interestingly, not always easy to get access to the information of that as well. Like who gets what money and where it's gone and all that sort of stuff. Even though it's a matter of public record, there's a giant chunk of it missing from the 90s to start with.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right in the middle where the funding crunch happens.
Really?
Yeah, there's about 3 or 4 years where nobody's got it, find it.
Oh, dear.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Okay.
Yoni Pryor, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Fascinating journey back into the Gilgal. You've been listening to the Witness Interview Podcast with Yoni Pryor, sound by Ben Keane, and I'm Robert Reed.